injected a little swagger into his walk. He knew they were behind him. His senses said so. His simple good sense said so. He knew as he left the bar that they would follow. The beers had gone to his head, affecting his gait and balance, a dislocation that needed to be thoughtfully overcome. He turned into the alley anyway. To do otherwise would have made him someone else entirely, which he would never allow. Sidney G. until the end. But this was not the end. It would take a bigger army than this. Besides, he could feel the cold steel against his side. Consider things equal.
"Hey, big man!"
A sharp call from behind him, in a voice he knew. A voice that had been in his face earlier tonight. Hey, she'd been sitting at the bar alone. How was he to know she was with this guy? And also, if it had worked, why should he have cared? But this was a small town, nothing like the real world. And this big, stiff redneck behind him had some other big, stiff rednecks on his small-town, small-time team. These fools thought fists would tell the final tale. "Dodo, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore."
"I'm talking to you, stupid."
Sidney G. stopped, wavered slightly, and turned around. There were four of them at the mouth of the alley, backlit by the streetlight, breathing clouds of steam into air left cold and clear by yesterday's rain. They moved up, the lady's sorry boyfriend in front, with his three stooges standing just to the rear, smiling in a sickening chorus. "Got you now, trash-talking city boy. That's what you think."
"So, big man, tell me again what you said about my mama."
Sidney G. smiled, breathed deeply, expanding his belly against his waistband and its bulge of cold metal.
"Hey, no, dude, that wasn't really true what I said about your mama. I didn't really do her."
The four men sneered, heavy with their own imagined power. "Got you on the run now, city boy? That's what you think."
"I mean, big ugly lady like that? I don't care how much she begged, just not into it."
Sidney smiled and pulled the gun out from under his coat. He was drunk, full-on drunk. Drunk enough to make a mistake. A really stupid mistake. Like facing four men in an alley, never stopping to look behind his back. He tried to clear his head too late. A strong hand grabbed his right wrist from behind. Another wrapped around his upper arm. A victim of his own slowed reflexes, Sidney G. sank to his knees under the pressure, felt the sickening cracking give in his elbow. Thought he was going to throw up from the pain. Thank God he was oiled. Man, that would hurt like a son of a bitch in the morning. If there was a morning.
Bent double with the pain, gun skittering over the pavement out of his reach, he felt the heavy boot dig into his gut, lifting him slightly off the ground. But he didn't cry or apologize or beg for mercy. He just spit on the man's shoes. Sidney G. to the end, which this seemed to be. When he first heard the sound, he was too drunk and in too much shock to know what it was. A bee buzzing near his ear, maybe. But the legs turned. All those legs he'd been staring through. And his head came up slightly, and he saw it. Like a mirage, haloed from behind in the night through all those legs. A little dude on a little scooter, revving the throttle like he thought he had a Harley underneath him. The little guy popped the clutch. The bike jumped and almost sprang a wheelie, then tore down the alley into the fray. The legs jumped to safety.
"God damn, Sidney, the cavalry!"
The little dude stopped beside Sidney G. and reached a hand down, and he took it, almost pulling the kid off the bike, like a drowning swimmer who nearly pulls down the lifeguard. Kid let go in order to pop the clutch again. Then, holding strong to the left hand Sidney gave him, he pulled Sidney to his feet. Sidney jumped for the seat, missed by a mile, fell to the pavement and was being half-dragged. Kid tore along out of reach of their pursuers, bouncing Sidney G. behind him. Sidney didn't take offense, though. Worse stuff waiting in that alley. Then the kid hit the brakes, spun the bike halfway around, nearly dumped it. Pulled hard, and Sidney got a leg over the back of the seat, grabbed a piece of the kid's jacket with his left, trailing his twisted right arm. They sat that way for a protracted second, listening to the rev of the engine, noticing that the five men had positioned themselves on both sides, blocking the alley in each direction. Three on one side, two on the other. A no-brainer. "Hold on," the kid said.
"Damn it, I'll try."
Kid shot the bike forward and whipped it around, hard to do in that little space, dabbing and correcting with his feet for balance, headed for the side that held only two. Hit the gas and went right at them. Sidney wondered how long it would take them to get smart and pick up the gun. One of the men caught the kid's sleeve and yanked, pulled him over sideways, trying to lay the bike down. "Hit him in the eye," Sidney told himself, but he had only one hand and he needed it to stay with the Crusader. The bike lurched over to the left. Sidney G put his foot down and so did the kid, fighting against the weight and crazy angle of the bike. "It'll never work," he thought. "We're going over." But then Sidney G rode bigger bikes. This one was light. One good push from each of them brought the machine half upright. The kid hit the gas and the bike lurched forward, wrenching his sleeve loose from the last redneck's grasp. They tore out of the alley, cornering right toward the freeway. Sidney heard a popping sound behind him, which he recognized as gunfire from his own weapon. But no impact or pain to go with it, other than the pain of leaving that gun behind. He'd miss it.
"What the hell did I ever do for you?"
he screamed into the kid's ear. But the wind and the engine roar took his words away. A wave of sickness and pain washed over him. They skidded onto the freeway ramp, Sidney G having enough to do, just holding on, just trying not to pass out. He flickered in and out of the space just underneath consciousness. The pain was there, waiting patiently for him. He'd go up and face it in a minute. He always had before. There was something clean and victorious about waking up feeling that bad. It meant he was alive still, that he'd survived again. He opened his eyes. The ceiling spun slightly. He looked down at his right arm, the source of the worst pain. It was clearly broken at the elbow, swollen to two or three times its normal size and pointing in an unnatural direction. He dug his pill container out of his jacket pocket with his left hand, spilled the contents out into his lap, found two Percodans and swallowed them without water. Then he lay there with his eyes closed, tallying up the damage. The tops of his knees felt bruised and abraded, but he didn't want to look down. Not yet. No significant movements until the pills kicked in. And he sensed a place in his gut that might even involve a cracked rib or two. Drawing a full, deep breath was somewhere between inadvisable and impossible. He drifted half asleep for a few minutes, and then it washed over him, the relief, like the throwing of a switch. Gradually muting the pain, pushing it so far into the background that it was practically not there at all. He moved to stand. Well, the pain was there, actually, but it almost felt like someone else was having it. He pulled to his feet and stood, wobbly and nauseous, looked around, found himself in a small, barely furnished apartment. No one else around. He walked to the open window, hoping fresh air would help. He found the kid outside the window, sitting on the roof. He looked skinny and pale, and no more than 20, and like somebody Sidney G would never hang with, never in a million years. "Hey," the kid said.
"Hey."
Sidney G breathed a sigh of relief, now consciously accepting that he was alive, and doped well enough on the perks to consider that a good thing.
"You must be the guy who pulled me out of there last night."
"Yeah, I would have taken you to the hospital, but you passed out. I could barely keep you on the bike. I had to hold on with your left arm over my shoulder. I couldn't work the clutch. Had to come all the way home in second. Didn't dare try to go any further."
"See?" Sidney thought.
Life had this way of being good to him. Just what he didn't need was a trip to the hospital. Start there, end up in jail. Wouldn't even be in this backward little whistle stop if he could afford for his whereabouts to be a matter of record. Stupid kid wouldn't have thought of that. But it worked out without a problem. He'd go back to L.A., quiet-like, and see that doctor who kept good secrets. Then he'd slip out of town again before anyone was the wiser.
"You know, kid, good thing you're not like me. Good thing for me, that is. I would have just sat at the end of that alley and laughed. Figured that son of a bitch brought it on himself."
The kid turned his eyes up to Sidney G., a dark, cold look on his face. No sense of humor. No style. A good haircut, but nothing to go with it. Nothing of substance inside.
Funny way to say thank you.
Sidney G. sat on the edge of the window. He didn't say thank you. Not unless he damn well got it in his head to. Sure as hell didn't say it on cue. He looked through the trees, down to the street, where a little snip of white from the kid's scooter showed through. Made him feel good to see it. Somewhere down deep, it made him feel good. Like it had last night.
Cute little scooter you got there. Ever ride a real bike?
Sidney G. took a cigarette out of his pocket, tried to light it with his left hand. Kid grabbed the smoke and the lighter away and threw them down into the street.
Hey!
Not in my place.
Sure. Hell of a nice place you got here. Real palace.
Bite me.
Excuse me?
You heard me. I said bite me.
The kid came in through the window. Sidney backed up, groggy from the pills. How could he have backed up? He never did, not even in the face of death. With that arm, he didn't even want it touched, jostled. Plus, he couldn't think straight. So he ended up with his back against a bare wall and this hopeless little punk right in his face.
It is a real bike. It's a damn good thing for you, a smaller. We'd both be dead. That guy who was trying to kill you had it almost over on his side. If I couldn't have held it up with one leg, we'd both be dead now. Why did I even do that? Why did I risk my life to help you? You're such an asshole.
Excuse me?
You heard me.
I could take you with one hand tied behind my back.
Go for it.
But then again, it was his good right that was tied. Besides, his stupid little brat had helped him, even if he was being a snot about it now.
Why did you anyway?
I didn't know you yet. Didn't know what an asshole you are.
Why would you help somebody you don't even know?
You wouldn't understand.
The kid backed up out of Sidney's face, and Sidney, who agreed that he probably wouldn't understand, went downstairs and found his cigarette and lighter on the front lawn. He sat smoking for a while, wondering what to do next. From an interview by Chris Chandler for Tracking the Movement, 1998. Sidney.
Well, I'm not such a bad guy. Am I such a bad guy? Just like everybody else, I guess, only they're dead and I'm still here. Do you think I'm such a bad guy?
Chris. I don't even know you, Sidney.
Well, kinda hurt my feelings that he took a disliking to me. Not that I care, I mean, what a jerk. But you sort of think, you know, somebody saves your life, it'll be special from that point on. Only thing special was when he told me about the movement. I didn't know yet. I had to wonder if it hit L.A. or if I'd be the one to get to bring it in. That's a bad way to hear it anyway. Somebody tells you you're not even good enough to sit on their front grass. But I'm still trying to get it, you know, why somebody take the time to do what he did. So he tells me about the movement. But then he says I'm not allowed to touch it. Do you believe that shit?
He was angry.
Did he tell you that?
Yeah, he did.
I don't believe that shit. Why? Because I talked down his little scooter? Why would he take that dislike to me? Like I got some kind of disease, I'll just destroy the whole thing. Movements are for the people. They belong to the people. I'm the people just as much as that blondie with the teeny tiny scooter.
Matt. His name is Matt.
Yeah, whatever. Nobody tells me what I can and can't touch.
Later, back in the city, in a run-down duplex in South Central, Sidney G. lay in bed beside her and told her he'd missed her, which was pretty much true. His right arm had been encased in a fiberglass cast almost from wrist to shoulder. It itched slightly in the heat, and the painkillers buzzed in his head. She asked how long he would stay this time.
Long as you want me to,
he said, even though it was nowhere close to the truth.
Stella, you don't think I'm an asshole, do you?
She snorted and rolled to face the wall.
You got your moments. Since when do you care what anybody thinks?
Well, I don't, I guess. Ever heard of pay it forward?
No, what the hell is it?
He tried to stroke her hair with his left hand, but she jerked her head away. She was mad again. Still, over something long over and done, something as basic as who and what he was, had always been to her.
A near movement.
What kind of movement?
He lay on his back with his left hand behind his head and told her as much as he knew about it. As much as the kid had told him, before kicking him out with so much as a ride to the train station. He even told her that the kid only explained it as an example of something Sidney could never be trusted to do. He wasn't sure why. Maybe because it was Stella and he had missed her some. But he explained that the kid had told him to go away and have no part of it, that he'd start over with somebody else, somebody who could be counted on to pay it forward. That he didn't even want Sidney's fingerprints on his precious living chain letter.
Kinda hurt my feelings.
You got no feelings.
Hey.
It's true.
So you do think I'm an asshole.
What the hell are you even telling me about this pay-it-forward thing anyway? Why are you even still thinking about it? What a stupid idea. Think how long that'd last in L.A.
I guess.
You gonna leave money for the kids this time?
If I could do some business today.
But the only business Sidney had on the books for that day was heading out of town again. He'd already stayed too long. From the Diary of Trevor.
I have no idea what happened between Reuben and Mom. Must have been really weird, though. Because now every time I see Reuben, he says, "So, Trevor, how's your mom?" And then he says, "So, does she ever ask about me?" Ask what, I'm always thinking. But it's usually better not to mix into these things. Then I get home and Mom says, "Ever see Reuben?" And I say, "Yeah, I see him all the time." And she says, "So, does he ever talk about me?" Sometimes I want to yell at them both. I want to say, just talk to each other. It's not that hard. I mean, this is not brain surgery, guys. But grown-ups hate it when you talk to them like that. So, I have this system. I never tell either one of them what they really want to know. Then, sooner or later, they're going to have to break down and talk to each other. Sometimes I worry that I'll be this weird about a girl when I grow up. I hate to think that.
Chapter 17. Arlene. Loretta stirred milk into her coffee cup with that little clink-clink sound that grated on Arlene's nerves. Loretta's Mr. Coffee machine was broken again, and since she had never been any too fond of instant, she had shown up at Arlene's house for coffee this morning. Arlene's Mr. Coffee machine never broke, so she was forced to conclude that Loretta used hers too hard. Arlene decided that when she had 2 years sober like Loretta, she would not drink 22 cups of coffee a day. Then, realizing the uppity sound of that sentiment, she mentally changed the wording, if she ever had 2 years sober. It wasn't as easy as it looked in the directions. Usually she liked having Loretta around, the more the better, but she'd been out of sorts the past week, so much so that she hadn't phoned her sponsor once, a detail not lost on Bonnie. Loretta's voice broke the stillness.
You don't talk much about him anymore.
Who?
What do you mean, who? That guy he was all fired up about.
Oh.
Somehow she thought Loretta meant Ricky, a fact she couldn't explain and chose not to mention.
I guess I've been sort of avoiding him.
Didn't go so good, huh?
What?
You know, sleeping with him.
No, it went fine.
I'll bet.
It was nice, really.
Has he got a lot more scars when he gets his clothes off? I mean, are you, like, touching them everywhere you touch?
Arlene combed her hair back with her fingers and wished she still smoked. Or that there was a pack around here somewhere so she could fall off that wagon. There were more scars when he took off his clothes, around his ribs on the left, and that arm looked real funny. But she hadn't noticed until morning, and it wasn't that big of a deal.
No, Loretta, it's not that. He doesn't have scars like...
What?
Down there?
No.
Arlene stood up and walked to the stove. This was going to get girl talk personal, and soon she'd end up spilling the part she didn't even want to know herself. Arriving at the stove, she saw that her cup was full and couldn't find another good reason to be there.
No... Down there, he's just about what I expect him to be, only more so.
So? What's the problem?
I wish I knew.
She sat back down, head in hands. This could not be delayed any longer.
Last time we went out, he didn't stay over. He was acting kind of funny. You know how people act.
No, I thought lots of different people acted lots of different ways.
I mean, how people act when they're trying to say something...
Didn't you ever do that? Practice in the mirror, something you gotta say, and then when you see them, it just sort of hangs there? Like everybody can hear it. I kept thinking the waiter could hear it. So, what did he say? He never did. But I know anyway. He was trying to break up with me. I could tell.
You don't know that until you ask him.
I know now. You should ask him. Then he might tell me.
She could see Trevor out the window, playing on the garage roof with his friend Joe. She'd never exactly told him not to, but he must have known she wouldn't like it all that well. When she stuck her head out the kitchen window, he climbed back onto the plum tree and waved.
So, you gotta talk to him sometime. I thought maybe I'd go over to his house with Trevor.
That had worked out unexpectedly well last time, but it seemed a tenuous thread, a little tricky to explain, so she didn't try.
So, now it's a big deal that he not break up with you? Why does that seem so strange? Last I heard, he was just for sex till Ricky come home.
Arlene rocked back in her chair and fixed Loretta with that look she reserved for the immature, the rude, and the plain stupid.
Ricky ain't coming back. Don't you know that, Loretta?
Loretta's eyebrows arched.
Don't I know that? Don't I know? Honey, on last count, the only living soul on the face of the planet to not know that was you.
Arlene sighed and threw the last of her coffee down the sink drain.
Well, I demanded a recount, she said.
When Trevor bounced through the kitchen door, she told Loretta to get lost. She said it in a kind of sign language, the kind that works only when you've known somebody a long time.
I was just going to have one more cup, Arlene.
Arlene picked up the Mr. Coffee machine, pulling the plug out of the wall as she carried it away from the counter. Three more cups worth sloshed in the pot.
Be my guest,
she said, and handed the whole mess to Loretta.
Well, a brick wall don't have to fall on me.
But damned if she didn't take the machine with her.
Hi, Mom. How come you gave Loretta the coffee machine?
Oh, no special reason, honey. Listen, you ever see Mr. St. Clair now that school's out?
Sure, Mom, I see him all the time.
Where exactly?
I go over to his house.
Oh, we should do that. Sometime. Together.
Okay. Now?
Well, maybe not now.
Why not now?
I didn't call or anything.
I never call. I just ride my bike over.
Well, that's different, though, honey. With you.
Why is it different?
Give me a minute to think.
On their way over in the car, which had been making a troublesome noise lately, she asked yet again,
When you go over there, Trevor, and talk to him, does he ever, like, ask about me?
Yeah.
How many times?
Every time.
Really?
Yeah, really.
What does he ask?
Well, he always says, How's your mother, Trevor? And then I say, Oh, fine, she's fine. And then he says, So, Trevor, does she ever ask about me?
A long silence.
If he asked you to marry him, would you?
He ain't gonna ask me that.
If he did?
He won't. Can we talk about something else?
It was time to change the subject anyway. It wasn't a very long drive. When he answered the door, Trevor just bounced right in like he lived there.
Hi, Reuben,
he called on his way by.
Hi, Trevor. Arlene. This is a surprise.
He was in sweat clothes and unshaven, which looked kind of funny, the way the hairs grew only on one side. And he looked sad. Not that any of that mattered to Arlene, who was busy noticing how much she'd missed him. It was a big, heavy feeling, suddenly almost more than her insides could hold.
Sorry I didn't call first, but...
But what, Arlene? How are you going to finish that sentence? But I didn't want to give you a chance to say no. Don't bother. Or worse yet, to hear him say her name in that awful way. The way someone does when they start a sentence that's going to hurt like all hell.
It's okay. Come in.
She did, and stood feeling awkward, aware of Trevor watching, not sure what to say. It wouldn't be like the last time when they were unpacking and Trevor was all lost in another world. She wouldn't be able to really talk. But then again, she consoled herself, neither would he.
Trevor, where do you get off calling Mr. St. Clair by his first name? I didn't raise you up like that.
He said I could, just for the summer. When I get back at his class in the fall, I gotta switch back.
It's true. I said he could.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere in the world, Arlene knew there was something more to say, if she could only find it. She perched on his couch, and he brought her a ginger ale. The silence felt bigger than anything the house could contain.
Trevor said, "Where's Miss Liza?"
"I haven't seen her for a while. I think she's out in the backyard stalking birds."
"I'll go see."
He thundered off, leaving Arlene with room to speak, which she now no longer wanted.
"Arlene, I..."
She jumped in fast, before he could say what she knew he would say if she wasn't careful.
"I really missed you."
"You did?"
He sounded surprised.
"Oh, yeah. Little things. I got used to having you around."
"What kind of little things?"
"Oh, just, you know."
She knew he didn't.
"Like the funny messages you used to leave on my machine. I don't remember any word for word, but they were funny. I miss things like that."
"I'm sorry I didn't call. I've had a lot on my mind."
"Yeah, me too."
"Yeah, that's what they all say." She reached out and touched his right cheek, the stubbly one. She was making a fool of herself, she knew, but she didn't care. She was almost ready to beg. Everybody regards that as so unthinkable, but somewhere in the back of her mind she figured people do it all the time.
"Just listen to popular music and you'll hear it. I'd get down on my knees for you. Ain't too proud to beg. Baby, please don't go."
She was just getting ready to tell him it was the sex more than anything that she missed. Well, not even the sex itself, though that too, but the frightening closeness that came along. She was just getting ready to tell him that she couldn't give it up again, not so soon, even though later wouldn't be any better. Before she could, Trevor came back in with the cat draped over his shoulder. They stayed for an hour or so, during which Arlene spent most of the time marveling at the ease with which Reuben and Trevor talked to each other. She watched closely, like it was something she could learn. The following night he called and asked her to dinner at his house. He said he was all settled in and felt ready to cook.
"I was hoping to get your machine," he said. "I was going to leave a funny message."
"Want me to hang up so you can call back?"
"No, that's okay. I'll try to be funny when I see you."
That's when she first realized that he had never been funny before. Not face to face, only as a voice on a tape.
"Reuben?"
"Yes?"
She hated the way she said his name. That big, awful, weighty way that people do before bad news. She knew it came through that way, too. Heard it in his voice. Everybody hates to hear their name spoken that way.
"The last time we went out?"
"Yes."
"I know what it was you were going to say to me."
"You do?"
"Yeah, I do. But don't say it, okay? Please? Just don't."
"Okay. I won't."
He sounded... She couldn't put her finger on it. Hurt? Relieved?
"You won't?"
"Not if you don't want me to."
"Wow," she thought as she hung up the phone. Who'd have thought it would be that easy? She'd never been in Reuben's bed before, which was huge and comfortable. The sheets felt new and crisp. She lay on his right side with one leg thrown over him, running her fingers through the hair on his chest, then stroking over his ribs, feeling the scars under her fingers like a topographical map, just to remind herself where she was. They felt good to her touch, because if they hadn't been there, this wouldn't have been Reuben. She wasn't sure if she was asleep. She allowed herself to drift into a feeling, a sense, that she somehow watched all this from above. Not so much physically, but more in a sense of perspective. She'd been so sure it was over, but if she could have gotten up a little higher, seen a little further, she might have been able to see this. She wondered if she would remember this feeling next time something seemed, in the short run, to be going wrong. She knew she probably would not. She knew people transcended that line of knowledge all the time, but damned if they didn't tend to cross right back again, she whispered quietly, hoping to plant words in his head without waking him, without really calling attention to herself.
I'm so glad you decided not to break up with me.
His eye opened, and he blinked and swallowed as though he'd been half asleep.
Break up with you?
Yeah, but let's not even talk about that now.
I was never going to break up with you.
You weren't?
She propped herself up on one elbow, as if staring more closely might help.
Well, what were you going to say to me then?
Is that what you thought I was trying to say last time?
Yeah, it wasn't?
So that's what you asked me to please not say?
Yeah. What was it then?
She watched his chest rise with an intake of breath. Having had guys ask her some pretty weird things, usually things that tested her moral flexibility, the waiting wasn't to her liking.
Never mind. You wouldn't have liked it.
Maybe not, but you damn well know I gotta hear it now.
Well, don't laugh, okay? I was gonna ask you to marry me.
Arlene's throat felt tight. Even if she had known what to say, which she did not, she probably couldn't have said it. He braved the silence for a remarkable length of time. Then he said,
Well, not right away. I just thought we could be engaged for as long as it takes to get to know each other well enough to take that step. I thought it might be better for Trevor if I was his mother's fiancé instead of just a guy who sleeps over. And better for you. Not in that order, though. I thought of you first. I thought you'd feel better wearing an engagement ring, even if we didn't set a date right away. It was meant as a symbol of my intentions, which are honorable. Are you ever going to say something?
You bought a ring?
That was something. Probably as good a something as any other.
I guess I did.
Where exactly is this ring right now?
In my dresser drawer.
She rolled away and lay on her back with her head on her own pillow. Reuben had a textured ceiling. That was most of what she remembered from the pursuant silence. She wanted to ask which drawer, but she never did.
Just think about it,
he said.
Don't answer now. Just think about it.
She said she would. She didn't say she wouldn't think about anything else, that she'd be up all night thinking about it. But that's the way it turned out to be. Chapter 18. Reuben. Arlene had fixed chicken fajitas, Trevor's favorite, to honor the special occasion. Reuben ate too many, the way he had that first night in this house. The same house felt warmer now. Now and then he glanced over at her, expecting a sign. She had her hair done up, and she was wearing the ring on her left hand, but if Trevor had noticed, he'd fail to comment. Reuben figured he hadn't noticed. It wasn't like Trevor to fail to comment.
Want me to clear the table, Mom?
He said at last, breaking the quiet.
In a minute, honey. Reuben and I have something we want to tell you. Okay, what?
I think Reuben wants to tell you.
Okay, what?
Trevor, your mother and I have made a big decision that affects you.
Okay. What?
We've decided to be engaged.
Engaged? Like, to be married?
That's right.
He glanced over at Arlene, still holding her fork tightly, her eyes closed, as if the words might hurt.
Yes!
Trevor shouted, startling Arlene's eyes open.
Yes! I knew it! I told you! This is so completely cool!
He jumped up from the table and launched into a little dance, which Arlene said made him look just like Deion Sanders. Reuben said,
Who's Deion Sanders?
He looked up to see both Arlene and Trevor staring with their mouths open.
Who's Deion Sanders?
Trevor asked, a study in astonishment.
You're kidding, right?
Arlene rose to collect the dinner dishes, obviously more comfortable now that the tension had been broken.
Trevor, honey, not everybody follows football. Even so, Deion Sanders!
He sat back down, elbows on the table.
Don't you ever watch football, Reuben? Hey, I just saw something. Can I call you Dad now? Am I supposed to call you Dad?
Reuben felt a little warm spot grow behind his ribs. a place that for so long had known only pain.
That would be fine, Trevor, if you're comfortable with that, and if your mother is.
Arlene looked at them both and nodded.
So, this Deion Sanders, does he play for the 49ers?
Trevor rolled his eyes.
Boy, we got a lot of work to do on you.
I thought Trevor was a 49ers fan,
Reuben said when she came back from tucking Trevor into bed. She slid under the covers, igniting that spot of warmth again. Not even so much sexual, though it could easily enough cross that line. Just comfort. A sort only barely familiar.
He is, but Deion Sanders plays for Atlanta, so he's sort of an Atlanta fan, too. When Atlanta plays San Francisco, he just can't handle it. He gets so upset he can't even watch.
I love you, Arlene.
The words seemed to reverberate in a suddenly empty room. Reuben wondered who was more amazed to hear them.
We're going to make a great family, she said after a time. He sure loves you.
And then it dawned on Reuben, a thought he'd never had before. It was a sweet thought, but at the same time it stung somehow. He'd never quite known, or let himself know, how much he'd been missing by sealing himself so completely away from others.
I should go kiss him goodnight.
Yeah, I think he'd like that.
Yeah, I think we both would.
From the chin down, Trevor lay covered in a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles bedspread. The light from the street lamp showed the left side of the boy's face in a soft glow.
Hey,
Reuben said, and sat down on the edge of his bed.
Hey!
And then, as a pleasant afterthought,
Dad?
A smile broke on his face and came all the way out of hiding.
Doesn't that sound cool?
Reuben felt the contagion of the smile sneak onto his own face.
Very cool.
They sat quietly for a minute.
Maybe we can watch some games together.
Cool.
I warn you, I don't know the first thing about football.
I could teach you. You know what? This means something went right with my project after all.
I was thinking about that. About paying it forward. I was wondering how I'm going to do that. How do you do that, Trevor?
What do you mean? It's not a how exactly. You just do.
Well, how do you think of things to do for people? I'm afraid I don't have your imagination.
You don't think it up with imagination. You just look around. Until you see somebody who needs something.
That sounds easy.
Everybody needs something. How far would you have to look?
It is easy.
If you're a child, Reuben thought.
Good night, Trevor.
Night, Dad. Is Mom happy?
I think so. I think we both are.
From Those Who Knew Trevor Speak.
Actually, I think she was scared to death. But isn't everybody at a time like that, faced with such a big decision? I was scared to death, too, but I had every intention of going through with it. But there was also, to complicate things for her. I mean, his name came up here and there, which seemed normal to me. I still expected it would work out. Until that day. October 19th, 1992. It's one of those dates you don't forget. In fact, you don't forget anything about it. You remember the jingle that was playing on the television. You remember the thought that was spinning around in your head a split second beforehand, when everything was still in order. It's trite to say, but your life divides up into before and after, and you don't have trouble placing things in time anymore. You can almost date them. Something like B.C. and A.D., I guess it sounds like I'm wasting a lot of time feeling sorry for myself. I won't lie. I haven't completely let go of it. In some ways I have. Not always. I'm probably being too sensitive. Maybe other people's wounds heal in a reasonable space of time. No. I take that back. They don't.
Chapter 19. October 19th, 1992. Reuben sat on the couch, sharing a bag of microwave popcorn with Trevor. Now and then a piece fell, only to be retrieved by Miss Liza, who spent most of her time at Arlene's now, with the rest of the family. Every time she ate a kernel, Trevor told her that cats aren't supposed to like popcorn. She seemed unconcerned. They watched Buffalo play the Raiders, a good game for Trevor to use as a teaching tool since he wasn't overly concerned about the outcome. He cheered for Buffalo, but not so much that he couldn't breathe. Just as the game had gone to commercial, Trevor had been attempting to teach Reuben the difference between a touchback and a safety, also between a touchback after an end zone interception and a touchback after a kickoff. Reuben figured he had most of the basics by now, but might have been unclear on these few details. A Coca-Cola commercial came on, the jingle familiar, destined to become too familiar, because now Reuben always thinks about it in connection with everything else. Not on purpose. He just hears it in his head every time the whole ordeal plays through again, which it still does from time to time. Trevor was feeding Miss Liza a piece of popcorn on purpose. She stood up on her hind legs to take it, one paw braced on Trevor's jeans, one poised in the air as if she might need to bat the prize away. It should have been a good moment, a good day, a good life. By all rights, it should have been. Reuben heard a knock on the door. Arlene called in from the kitchen, said she would get it. She swung the door open. Reuben looked up, waited for her to say something. He couldn't see her face, just the back of her head. But he wanted to see her face for some reason. A man stood in the doorway, saying nothing. A wiry, rather small man with dark, curly hair. The silence seemed to twist into Reuben's stomach somehow, as if stomachs can know things without needing to be taught. Reuben glanced over at Trevor, who stared at the doorway, his eyes fixed and expressionless. That cola jingle kept going against the back of Reuben's brain. Somebody had to say something, and it was the stranger who finally spoke.
"You don't seem too happy to see me."
Arlene stomped into the bedroom and slammed the door. Alone in the empty, open doorway, the wiry little man turned his attention to Trevor.
"Aren't you even going to say hello?"
"Hello."
Trevor's voice sounded hollow and cold. It never had before. That was the moment, really, that Reuben knew something had happened. Something irrevocable. Trevor never talked that way to anybody.
"You don't call me Daddy no more?"
Reuben felt Trevor cast him a sideways glance. This was all building up to hurt. But he couldn't feel it yet. Just a numbness. A shock. The kind that allows almost anybody to survive almost anything against their own bets.
"You said never call you Daddy in front of people."
"Well, that was before, boy. That was then, this is now. You don't even sound like you're happy. I'm back. What's the matter, boy? Cat got your tongue?"
Trevor launched himself off the couch and ran for his bedroom, slamming the door hard enough to make Reuben wince. The man crossed the living room to the couch and stood over Reuben, towered over him. Just stand up, Reuben thought, because he would surely be a full head taller and outweigh this little man by half again. But his body didn't do anything he told it to do. The man looked him over the way people who haven't seen his face tend to do, but openly, as though Reuben wasn't looking.
"Who the hell are you?"
he said. Chapter 20. Gordy. Gordy had a date with a man he'd met on the Internet. Gordy loved the Internet. The one thing that 2,000 miles from his old home, his real father, his old familiar life, hadn't changed. Gordy loved things that never changed. The man called himself Wolf, though surely it was not his name. On the screen, you can become whatever you've always wanted to be, and Gordy had become Sheila. Until later that night, how was Wolf to know? Wolf suggested they meet on Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House, right against the White House fence. That was fine with Gordy. In fact, he wondered why he hadn't thought of it before. The street would be crawling with Secret Service and D.C. City cops. Maybe Gordy wouldn't get beat up this time. Maybe that's the one place he'd be safe. He spent an hour on his makeup. Ralph, his stepfather, watched TV in his recliner in the living room. Standing quietly in the kitchen doorway, Gordy could hear the slight click of his breathing, almost a snore. He slipped by Ralph's chair with his head turned away, and Ralph did not wake up. Gordy stepped out into the city night. In his pocket, he held enough money for bus fare to get there. He jingled it through his fingers. It was not enough to get back. Maybe Wolf would drive him. Maybe Wolf would be different and wouldn't want to send him home at all. Or maybe he'd have to walk. He should have brought something to wash the makeup off his face in case that happened, cold cream or something. But he hadn't. He'd chosen to believe that this night he would not be making his way home alone. He climbed the shallow stairs of the city bus, blinking in the glare of the light. The driver handed him a transfer as if he wished he were wearing rubber gloves, flinging the piece of paper forward so their hands would not touch. It fell into the aisle. Gordy bent down to pick it up and heard a snicker behind him. He should have worn a longer coat over his tight satin pants, the ones with the zipper in the back. Should have done all kinds of things. Should have admitted that the world he stepped into that night was the real one. He sat right behind the driver, his eyes on the filthy aisle floor, careful not to meet the eyes of the snickerers. It was a trick he'd learned from a movie about gorillas, exaggeratedly averting your gaze to avoid aggression. It only worked about half the time. Gordy figured it probably worked better on the gorillas. Probably they were more civilized. Gordy paced up and down in front of the iron fence that surrounded the White House. Tourist couples walked by hand in hand, tugging on the arms of their children to bring them in close. Uniformed cops strolled by, stared into Gordy's face, shook their heads or clicked their tongues in judgment. Everybody felt free to judge. It never occurred to anyone to hold their opinion in silence. Their breath clouded steamy in the biting October air. He glanced at his watch. Nearly 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, Wolf would officially be 2 hours late. Gordy would be left to wonder if he had failed to show at all, or if he had arrived, seen the perfect cliché white carnation and the young male who wore it, and gone home again. Or maybe gone out and picked up a prostitute, a woman. Anything to keep from going home alone. That was the one part of all this that Gordy truly understood. After a glimmer of hope that there would be company for the evening, almost anything would be better now than going home alone. If Wolf had shown up and beaten the hell out of him for being Gordy rather than Sheila, that would almost have been better. Then in the morning he could go to school with his tongue gently exploring a swollen lip or a cracked tooth. He would know at least that something had happened. He would bet he was alive. Nobody would beat him up at school because the bruises would satisfy them that he had received his due already. He glanced at his watch again. It was after 10 now. He would have to walk home. A uniformed cop cruised by on foot, straining to look into Gordy's face like a rubberneck at a tragic accident. The cop had dark, oily hair slicked back under his cap and a broad nose. Handsome in a macho sort of way, Gordy thought. He seemed to find Gordy predictably disgusting, but Gordy knew he wouldn't use his fists to say so. He just knew. After all these years, he could tell danger before it struck. He couldn't stop it, though, just see it coming.
"Excuse me, sir."
"What?" The cop stopped suddenly, rocking forward slightly on his toes.
"I seem to have gotten stuck out here with no bus fare."
"Get your pocket picked or something?"
"Yeah."
"Okay."
"What the hell are you pacing out here for? I've been watching you for 2 hours. Is this like a solicitation thing?"
"Oh, no, sir. I was supposed to meet a friend."
"Because if I thought you were out here peddling your services, I'd run you in so fast. Hey, how old are you, kid?"
18.
"Yeah, sure you are. What's it to me if you got bus fare?"
That's when Gordy knew the cop would give him money to get home.
"I just thought, well, It's a long walk. I could get hurt, you know.
The cop moved his head as if to study Gordy's face from additional angles.
You sure as hell could. Why don't you wash that crap off your face if you don't want to get hurt? Here.
He handed Gordy a clean, folded white handkerchief from his shirt pocket. Gordy took it obediently and wiped his face, feeling a sense of loss. It had been a damn near perfect makeup job. It had looked smashing. He hated himself already, felt ugly without it. Dark, flesh-colored smears and streaks of black mascara marred the perfect white cloth now. He tried to go easy around the eyes. Maybe some of the green shadow would survive. He tried to hand the handkerchief back, but the cop threw his hands up in disgust. Gordy folded the smeary mess to the inside and stuck it in his pocket. He liked that he could keep it. Nobody ever gave him anything.
Is that better?
Shoot, kid, not much. Still looks like hell. Look.
He dug in his uniform pants pocket and handed Gordy three $1 bills.
Go home, wash your face. Don't let me see you around here again.
Thank you, sir,
Gordy said, and took off at a half trot, feeling somehow warmed. Gordy clutched his bus transfer in one hand, fingernails digging through the paper. Halfway home, don't blow it now. He stared through the window into the lighted chamber of the bar. It looked welcoming. He had a fake ID, out of state though it was. If they wanted to believe it, they might. No women inside that he could see, but he could be wrong. Could be a bunch of good old boys on a night out from the wives. He could learn that too late. No money for a drink, but someone might buy him one. Gordy just hated like hell to go home alone. Hated to go home at all. He could wash his face for real in the men's room, save himself a hell of a beating if his stepfather was awake and caught him coming in. Three men appeared in the doorway, stepped out toward him onto the street. My God, what had he been thinking? He'd really done it now.
What the hell are you?
One of the men called out, louder than necessary. Gordy turned quickly and headed for the bus stop. He could hear the click of his own heels in his head. In fact, for a moment, he couldn't hear anything else. Then, from behind him,
got a nice little swish to her walk. Hey, you hear me talking to you, boy?
You sure that's a boy?
Two voices. Maybe there were only two of them now. He glanced over his shoulder and saw all three gaining ground on him. He broke into a sprint. A light, powdery snow began to fall. A split second later, something caught him around his legs. His feet came out from under him, and he pitched forward. It seemed to take a long time to fall. On the way down, he thought about the cop who gave him the handkerchief and the $3. If he was here now, watching, would he help? Or laugh? His chin struck hard on the concrete, and he felt the wind go out of him. He saw some kind of color explode inside his head, behind his eyes. Felt a big male body on top of him, pinning him. Couldn't breathe.
You wish, huh, boy?
A slight downward pressure, like a simulation of anal sex. Why was sex always the insult of choice? Gordy felt blessedly removed from this thought, from his body, a gentle sense of shock that always kicked in to help him survive. Then the great weight lifted and a hand pulled him up to his knees by the back of his hair. He wavered there for an instant, free and unrestrained. A hard shoe in the middle of his back knocked him forward again. He fell loosely like a sock doll, struck his nose on the concrete, felt the blood flow down his lip and tasted its metallic flavor at the back of his throat. Something personal and familiar. A third voice sounded, hollow in his ears, distant, as if from the end of a long tunnel. His ears felt plugged and they rang.
Oh, shit, he's just a little boy. I'm going back to the bar.
Maybe you don't know he's not a little girl.
It was the voice of the man who'd pinned him.
I'll leave him be, Jack. Come on.
Gordy lay motionless on the cold sidewalk, playing dead. Nothing touched him. He thought he heard their footsteps walk away, but there were other footsteps. People walking up and down this street. They'd been there all along, he realized. He'd been too busy to notice. His senses acutely alive now, he heard the click of their shoes as they cut a wide circle around him. Blood from his nose pooled around his fingers as he pushed to his feet. From The Other Faces Behind the Movement.
You know, I got death threats after it first happened. Can you explain to me how it was my fault? Enough people say it is, though, you start to wonder. Like, if I hadn't been out that night, if I'd gone out the next night, the kid would have made it to the airport by then. He'd be back in his hometown. I guess everybody's thinking it should have been me. I'm just so damned expendable. I'm sorry. I don't mean to sound bitter. I think if there's a message in all this, it's that things happen the way they're supposed to, the way they have to. I couldn't have gone out on a different night, and the kid couldn't have made it out of the city that night. Look how much good came in the long run. It's not my fault. People just like to put a name and a face on their hatred. My face goes real well with hatred. I've noticed that. It's better now, though. It was hard for the first few months, but now, everything's better now.
His mother was home from work. The good news. Ralph was still awake. The bad. Gordy held the smeary handkerchief to his nose and tried to slip by. If only his mother would let him slip by. But she wanted to see his face, so Ralph saw it too.
"Oh, honey,"
she said, grabbing Gordy's arm. He tried to pull away, but he felt so weak and shaky.
"Oh, Gordy, honey, what happened to you?"
She turned him around and tried to move the handkerchief away. His only cover.
"Nothing, Ma. I'm fine. I fell down, is all."
She disappeared suddenly, pushed out of the way by her new husband. Ralph loomed in his face, holding Gordy's wrist to keep him from running. Gordy longed suddenly for the familiar company of the three men from the bar. They seemed safer in comparison. At least, they were not in his home.
"What the hell's all over your face, boy?"
He felt the back of Ralph's hand, hard. He heard his mother scream. Gordy fell easily, steadied himself on hands and knees, tried to keep his head down. "No more, not tonight, please, no more tonight." He wiggled a loose molar with his tongue.
"Stand up to me, boy, you hear?"
A roar, a bellow like the roar of a forest fire out of control. He did not stand up. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw his mother grab Ralph from behind, grab him with her arms around his neck. They yelled at each other, but Gordy couldn't make out the words. Ralph shook her off, turned back to Gordy. But Gordy had seen that brief window of opportunity and used it. He lunged from his crouched position like a runner at the gun. He locked the door of his room before Ralph could catch him. The door shuddered when Ralph hit it. Gordy wedged a chair under the knob. His hands trembled, a feeling that ran all the way to a place inside his gut. A second strike came, followed by the sound of wood splintering. But the door held. Then relative quiet. Gordy could hear his mother's voice, the steady, comforting litany of it. Couldn't make out all the words, though. Something about how Ralph should take some nice deep breaths and she would fix him a nice drink. Their footsteps moved off down the hall. Gordy washed his face in his bathroom sink. The comfort of warm water, the sting of soap. Leftover blood and makeup swirled down the drain. Then he lay on his back on the bed, wondering what Wolf might have looked like. Wishing he had aspirin, but they were in the kitchen. In time, he heard a shy, gentle knock that he knew was his mother. He rose painfully and unlocked the door, then lay down again.
"Lock it behind you, Ma. He's asleep, sweetie. Passed out, you mean."
She didn't answer. She sat on the edge of his bed and handed him 3 aspirin and a half glass of water. He swallowed the aspirin. She gave him an ice bag for his face. He wanted to put it everywhere at once. His head pounded with pain. His chin and nose felt painfully swollen. His jaw ached at the spot of the loose teeth. He put the bag over his nose and eyes. The world disappeared.
"He's not a bad man, honey. It just makes him mad. If you could just wash your face before you come home, maybe change your clothes. Just don't rub his nose in it, you know?" "Sure, Ma. Okay, I will. He's not a bad man, Ma.
I just want to go to sleep. I don't really want to talk tonight, okay? I just want to go to sleep.
He heard her slip out and close the door gently behind her. He woke hours later from a bad dream with